Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
Hey folks, welcome to the Projection Booth. This is your friend Mike White, and I am bringing you a special episode all about Stories from the Trenches, the official Sam Furstenberg book that is going to be coming out pretty soon from author Marco Zitelman. He is currently running a Kickstarter. We'll have links available to that over at projection-booth.com. Just a few more days to go, so be sure to get out there and donate. Pretty much you're pre-ordering your copy of it. And if you want to know more about Sam Furstenberg, you want to know why you should be buying this book, we also have an interview with Mr. Sam Furstenberg. But first up, let's go ahead and roll the interview with Marco Zitelman right now.
My name is Marco Zitelman. Basically, I'm a film journalist for about 10 years now. I've written for a lot of German language magazines, print and online, and I founded my own online magazine, which was called Hard Sensations. And from there, I went to publishing my interviews in books with my publishing company. That's basically the way.
What got you interested in writing about film?
Film was always a big passion for me since I was a kid, and not specifically action and horror cinema, which is what I am focusing with my publishing house. But I always loved all kinds of cinema. I grew up on exploring film in many ways, and it was always a very personal passion for me. I always wanted to make this into a profession, not necessarily to be a filmmaker myself, but to have something to do with movies.
This new book that you're working on, Stories from the Trenches, the official Sam Furstenberg book, this is not your first rodeo. You have done other books before.
I published a handful of books so far, and just one of them I was the co-author on, that was the untold, in-depth, outrageously true story about Shapiro Glickenhaus Entertainment. The whole era of home video and the mid-budget commercial independent movies of the 80s and 90s, I think they are not very much explored in terms of film history, and I think it's an interesting era in many ways. That's why I'm focusing on it.
And tell me, you've also written a little bit about one of my favorite filmmakers, which is Wakefield Poole. Can you tell me about the work that you've done on him?
I also interviewed a lot of people from the golden age of porn, and Wakefield was one of the first filmmakers I ever tried to get in touch with, because I wasn't able to find some of his movies, and I was interested in them, and that was the reason to contact him. And it was a very nice collaboration. We made an interview with him on my old online magazine, and we still have a very nice personal connection. And I thought his career is interesting enough to dedicate him an interview book on his own. The book, which is called I've Seen It All, Conversations with Wakefield Poole, is a mix, a combination of older interviews from the 70s and 90s, and exclusive interviews I did with Wakefield. And we put them together into an interview collection, which is covering all steps in his filmmaking career, and also some personal chapters. Basically the same conception I have for the Sam Furstenberg book.
Yeah, tell me, how did you get involved with the Furstenberg project?
Because of the Shapiro Glickenhaus book, I got in touch with many people from the Canon Group Heritage, and I always was interested in publishing something about Canon, but for many reasons, I don't think Canon can be covered in a single publication just because they have such an enormous output and so many stories to tell from so many filmmakers and crew people. It was totally clear for me that that I want to split the Canon history up into some chapters, and I want to dedicate one book to every filmmaker to make it a thorough and extended view back on a career. And I saw the documentary Electric Boogaloo about the Canon history, and immediately I got the impression that Sam is a very nice guy to work with, and I just was interested in him because of his personality. And I reached out to him, and I wasn't surprised that he's actually the nice guy I thought he would be. And he's very supportive, and he's fun to work with. He's very entertaining, a good storyteller. And it's a very nice project to be involved in.
It's amazing to look at his filmography and see that he's the guy behind some of the best titles that are out there. I mean, Ninja 3, The Domination, I really enjoy. I mean, and everybody knows the title Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo. I mean, that title, just the title itself, yes, became famous. He's got a wealth of talent, and he must have some amazing stories about making these movies.
That's for sure. And Sam is a filmmaker that he's very unpretentious about his successful career. He's very conscious about the kind of film he was doing, and he loved it. He's a big fan of entertainment Hollywood filmmaking, and that shows in his movies, and I think they have a very specific signature in them. They are very playfulness, and they are colorful, and they are adventurous, and they are very perfect for a teenager audience who wants to see adventure on the screen.
So what's your approach with doing this book? Are you just pretty much interviewing Sam and getting his take on this, or are you doing more research on each film as it goes along? What's kind of the way that this is evolving for you?
The main part of the book are the conversations with Sam himself, of course. We recorded many hours of interviews, and we talked about pretty much every step of his filmmaking career, and also some other aspects of his life. We talked about his youth in Israel, his hobbies and his influences, how he got interested in cinema, and the awakening of the love of cinema, and basically we talked about every step of his career as an assistant director on the early films of Menachem Golan and Boaz Davidson, and about his first movie One More Chance, starring Kirstie Alley, and then we went through the Canon films and the New Image films. We talked about every single movie. We talked about the practical side of filmmaking, a little bit of gossip. We talked about his personal style of filmmaking, his philosophy of filmmaking, and that's basically it. I interviewed a lot of people Sam worked with throughout the years. There are interviews with actors like Brian Genesi or Judy Aronson or Michael Dudikoff and several others, and we have interviews with his editors and cinematographers, many crew people, assistant directors, producers, writers, with many different points of view, and many anecdotes from different, very different characters.
So we are talking today about this book, and as we're talking, there is a Kickstarter that is going on for this, and I think you're doing it really very smart, because one of the lowest barriers to entry with this Kickstarter is just pledging €16 and getting a digital version of the book. So you're basically pre-selling the book. And I think that's probably one of the smartest things that you can possibly do.
Yes, I thought so. It's to try to evolve one step forward as a publisher. Basically, we did the Shapiro Glickenhaus book. I did it with three of my friends, very much DIY, and it was a very long and stressful process. And the book was buried a little bit because we couldn't pay much for marketing and proper advertising. And we are trying to give the Sam Furstenberg book a bigger release and a more professional release, and hopefully reach out to much more people, because I think there is a readership for this.
Well, and I like that you also offer these other levels as well, where you can really, you know, you pull out all the stops. I mean, you've got signed posters as a level. You've got, of course, you know, thanks in the book as one. I mean, they're getting the Shapiro Glickenhaus book as another bonus. So you really do a good job of these tiers when it comes to helping support the book. Now, when it comes to, and there are some people listening to this podcast who might not actually know some of the travails that go into publishing a book. I mean, you mentioned some of those things like getting the word out, advertising, just the price of print itself is pretty huge. So what are some of the ways that, you know, because I think your goal is around, what, €10,000, somewhere around there?
Yes, right.
So how did you come up with that as your final goal, and where will that money go to?
I already invested much of my private money for the artwork and for many costs of mailing costs and telephone costs, and the research was very I needed much time for the research. There was already very much work you need to pay for a great artwork, and then this artwork has to be transformed in a proper book jacket, and you have to pay for the proofread, you have to pay for the layout, you have to send copies to everybody who was interviewed in the book, you have to pay for refreshing the pictures, and a lot of costs afterwards for every bit of marketing is very expensive if you want to have a good advertising or reach out to many people. All in all, it's very, very expensive to pay this for my own private money, and I would appreciate it very much to reach out to a bigger audience with this book.
When it comes to the work of Sam Furstenberg, what is the one movie that you would go back to time and again? What's the movie that you think people have to see out of his filmography?
It's very obvious that American Ninja is the movie that is the most recognized film in his career, and I think that is why it's an important film to understand the canon history, because it's a significant movie for them. But the best movie Sam directed, and I think he would agree with that, is Avenging Force with Michael Dudikoff and Steve James, and also produced by the Cannon Group. But it wasn't such a big success as American Ninja.
When it comes to some of the writers that Sam has worked with over the years, who are some of your favorite screenwriters that he's worked with?
It's an interesting thing that Sam often directed a movie that was based on a script written by an actor. I don't think there is a significant writer that shaped for the style of his films or would be my favorite writer. I think Sam's films are very much editor's movies, and his most fruitful and important creative collaborations were with editors like Michael Duffy.
So far, while you're doing your research on this, what is the most surprising thing that you've discovered?
It's not the biggest surprise because I already knew that the Canon films are recognized by a big amount of people for being childhood memories or teenager memories or early experiences in going to the movies. I'm still surprised that so many people from all over the world are writing to me because of a nostalgia they have with the films, and many people are still writing to Sam Furstenberg fan letters because they were influenced to start in martial arts, and later on they opened their own school or other people who were interested in the films in the 80s and became filmmakers themselves, or Israeli filmmakers from a younger generation that are encouraged by the success of the Canon films in the 80s. I think it's a very unique thing that so many people are emotionally influenced by the films, and there is still a lot of love for the Furstenberg films out there.
So if people want to find out more about Stories from the Trenches, the official Sam Furstenberg book, they can go over to Kickstarter, or I'll have a link available right on projection-booth.com where folks can go over and make their donation. Now, you still have a month to go, and you've got about, at the time of this recording, maybe about $7,000 to go, which is actually pretty darn good. I would say having $3,000 down, or $3,000, this is so weird because parts of it are in euros and parts of it are in dollars. So you've got about 7,000 grand more to go, and you've got a month left, and I think that you can make it. That's what I'm hoping. I hope that you do this because it is sounds like a terrific project. I've given my 16 euros, and I actually, by the time we are done with this, I will bump that up because this is one that I definitely believe in, and I hope more folks check out.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I hope that many Canon fans will recognize the campaign because I think they are out there, and I think they will be pleased with the book. I'm putting all of my passion in it.
All right, folks, once again, just a reminder to go on out to the Kickstarter, pre-order your copy of the book, and have it delivered to you electronically or via the post in the next coming months here. And without any further ado, we're going to hear from the director and the subject of Stories from the Trenches, Mr. Sam Furstenberg himself. You were born in Poland, but raised in Israel. How old were you when you moved over to Israel?
Actually, I arrived in Jerusalem when I was 6 months old, so I have no memories whatsoever from Poland. I understand from childhood a little bit Polish, but I don't have any influence, like cultural or memories or anything. I was practically born in Jerusalem.
Were you always into movies?
In Jerusalem, where I lived in Jerusalem, it was in a neighborhood, not in the center of town, but outside the city. And in our neighborhood, there was a local movie theater. And this kind of theater played in the noontime or some time in the afternoon, two movies, double bill in the matinee. And as a kid, I used to go to this theater once a week. They changed the movies. Every week they changed the movies. So, yeah, I was drawn to it as a kid. I it's hard to describe and to explain why, but that's what it was. I loved to see movies, and then I loved to come back and to tell the story of the movie to the rest of the kids in the neighborhood.
When did you decide to make that your profession?
Later on, when I was, teenager, high school, I kept going to the movies, not at the same type and not at the same pace. But I kept with it. And in Israel, you have mandatory military service. So I served in the military 3 years. So this brings you to 21 years old. And then I kind of decided to study cinema. I didn't know really if I'm going to make it into a profession, but to study cinema. And in where I lived when I grew up in Israel, there was no film schools. Today there are. So I always loved American cinema, Hollywood films, and I have decided that I'm going all the way to Los Angeles, to Hollywood, to study film. when I was here, when I say here, we're talking from Los Angeles. So when I was already here and I started to go to school, I was very lucky, I must say. And I look at it right away. I got a job in a television station here, local television station, as a cameraman. And not long after, I already got a job in my first job in a movie. But of course, then it became a profession already, and I knew what I wanted to do. Beginning, I didn't understand what it was, but then I understood that I wanted to become a director, and I started to work. So this is, we're talking in 1972, 1973.
Were your parents supportive of you moving all the way to Los Angeles?
My parents, the problem was not moving to Los Angeles at all, but prior to all of this story, I have studied electric engineering or electronics engineering. And my parents were for sure that I'm going to end up as an engineer, go to a higher education in engineering and ended up as an engineer. And suddenly I switched to this elusive profession, which is movie making, unclear what it is at all. So this was the point of contention, the point of friction, but not the movement itself, but rather how come I do not continue with the engineering.
What were some of those early films like that you were working on?
I started here to go to school. It's a college, Columbia College, and we studied the television and cinema. And I started right away to work with, to volunteer in any movie that will take me to volunteer, short movie, students. And then right away, I started to make my own short movies. The ones people make in school, 6 minutes, 10 minutes, etc. One day I met here a producer, director-producer by the name of Menachem Golan. And I knew his name from Israel, from my childhood. He was a very famous producer, director in Israel. And I met him here by chance in Los Angeles in some New Year party. And he was telling me that he was about to make a movie here in Los Angeles, in Hollywood. The name of the movie was Lepke with Tony Curtis. It's a gangster movie. And I asked him if I can join, I can come and work. And he was receptive. He agreed. And I came and I started to work with him. So it was not a small movie. It was decent size, decent budget movie. And I was, my job was undetermined. I was doing anything, mainly serving coffee and moving around chairs. So this was a gangster movie, kind of the type of thing I grew up with anyway, because our diet of movies were crime movie, gangster, westerns. And then the same company produced right away another movie, another gangster movie, The Four Deuces with Jack Palance. So I was moved from the first movie to the second movie as in the art director, set dressing. In the movie Lepke, I really followed the director, Menachem Golan, wherever he went. And I even went after shooting to with him to see dailies, to see the dailies every day. I was trying to whatever they let me get involved in, I did, beyond just being on the set. And I met on the movie, I was lucky enough, I met Andrew Davis. He was the cinematographer in the movie, and later on he became a famous director, Andrew Davis. And he encouraged me to move on and to really to try to make my way into assistant director. Then I worked on a low-budget movie that Charlie Band produced. He later became, it was the first movie he produced, Mention of Horror, I think it's called today. And later on, he produced a lot of low-budget horror picture. Another movie that was called The Adventure of Don Quixote. So those were kind of low-budget movies here in Los Angeles. At that point, suddenly, Menachem Golan, who I started with in Lepke, put together a production, another decent-sized movie. It was called Diamonds with Robert Shaw and Richard Roundtree. Richard Roundtree was Shaft. But the movie was to be shot in Israel, to be filmed in Israel, not here. So again, I asked if I can come and become an assistant director. And again, he agreed. And I went together with him back to Israel, to Tel Aviv, and I became a second assistant director in this kind of heist movie, you know, crime movie, Diamonds. And from that point on, I moved on and on doing my job as assistant director in other various movies. I stayed in Israel, and I was assistant director in many of local Israeli movies, which most of them were comedies. And that's it, all the way up to 79 when I was fed up. I made too many movies as assistant director. So these were the type of movies. None of them was a big studio movie. The only big movie that I was assistant director was the Operation Thunderbolt, the Raid of Entebbe, also with Menachem Golan. This was quite a big movie. And I also was an assistant director in a very big production, which was biblical story, the story of Jesus. It was like a big movie, 6 month shooting. It was beyond movie. It was like a 6 hour production, movie, story, or video, whatever you want to call it. And this was it. Later on, I moved to directing.
What was that working relationship like with Menachem Golan?
Well, I'll tell you, as an assistant director, not much. He was, at that point, he did not have Canon Film yet. He was directing or producing, and I was one of the crew, assistant director, more of the production crew, not the technical crew. And so those are a professional relationship, nothing special, you know. Do this, do that, and here's your check at the end of the week. Relationship really formed when I started to work with him as a director and he as my producer, and I directing movies for his company. And the interesting, the most interesting thing about his character, I think that he was a in-heart storyteller. This was the biggest characteristic of him, was that he was deep in heart a storyteller. He really loved to tell stories. Of course, he was people who knew him know that he was a bigger-than-life character, very busy with promoting himself, his own name, and his company. And his nickname was the Bulldozer. Nothing would stand in his way, on the path to him achieving whatever he wanted to do. So he was a bigger-than-life character. At some point, he was fighting with people, struggling in everything that he could do in order to achieve his goal, which was to either to finish the shooting day, to shoot this particular shot, to finish the movie. But I had a good experience with him. First of all, I was always paid in time for all the work I did for him and for his partner and cousin, Yoram Globus. And secondly, he was very supportive of me as a director. Usually, beside just giving me a script and telling me, go and make a movie, he did not bother me during shooting. I was really free to do whatever I wanted. he would come in and as kind of as advisor or boss later on in the editing, in post-production. He wanted to see the movie, how it was coming along, how is it edited, and giving his advice or his commands, whatever, any way you look at it. But it was always for the good of the movie, to advance the story, and that's nice to work with somebody who is so dedicated just to this idea of telling a good story, whatever it takes, within the realm of the low budget type of movies that we did.
What was that first directing effort like for you?
I will tell you, I started directing small. I didn't jump into a big movie right away. So I started in school, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. That's how you hone your mastery of the cinematic language, to master the cinematic language. And then I was an assistant director in many movies. So you're working next to a director and you see how he build up the movie. What does it take in terms of leadership or in terms of craftsmanship, leadership and craftsmanship to run a set with many people? The last thing that I did short, I directed a 30-minute movie. This was the last thing I did before I jumped into features. And that's already, 30 minutes. I already have to make decision as a director, to direct the crew, to direct the actors, to make sure that I know what I'm doing in terms of editing, and then spend hours, a lot of hours in editing room and mixing. So all the elements of making movie, I was familiar with. When I, at some point after I told you I was tired of assisting director, it was 1979, and I decided to go back to school for a graduate school, master degree, and this was in Loyola Marymount University here in Los Angeles. And while I was in school, usually it's required for the master degree to make a short movie, 25, 30 minutes, but I have decided to expand it into full feature, 1.5 hour, 90 minutes. And together with a friend, David Womack, who produced it, and together we shot this movie. And now, because it was school and because we didn't have the money and all the means, we were filming only in the weekends. And again, even here, I'm working on my knowledge about how you make movies. I advance in the technique, in ideas, and you learn from people. So when I got to the point that I was given a movie to direct by Canon Film, which was Revenge of the Ninja, full-fledged movie with big crew, with a non-stop schedule, by then I was pretty experienced in all the elements of making movies. I didn't need to be nervous or scared or anything like that.
Your student feature film, One More Chance, I don't recall a lot of ninjas in that movie. So I'm curious how it was moving from that into doing such a wild action film as far as that style of directing and crafting that style that you came up with.
You're correct about the shift, the big shift. So the way I saw myself as a director, the type of movies that I believed at the time that I will be directing were social commentary dramas, let's say, or crime dramas. I always like crime and social justice elements. And obviously, that's what I did. The name of the movie is One More Chance, and with Johnny LaMatta and Kirstie Alley. It talks about a criminal, ex-con coming out of prison and struggling within the society to make it. That's what I thought that I would be making, these kind of movies or adventures. And then I was presented by chance. I was asked to do an action movie. And one of the first questions, of course, that they asked me, the company asked me, can you handle action? And, you know, since I didn't want to lose this chance and being young and believer, I assure them that I will be able to handle action. And more so, suddenly I'm in this whole field of ninjas and martial arts. And I've not seen any martial art movie before I made this movie. You know, what was then at the beginning of the 80s, Hong Kong martial art movies, karate movies, you call them, kung fu movies. I never seen any of those. The only thing I saw in terms of this culture was samurai movies by Akira Kurosawa, which I liked a lot, very much. And but here again, I'm touching a point that if a person is a movie maker and he understands the element, the cinematic elements of telling a story, if you know how to tell a story through a cinematic elements, from a technical point of view, let's say, or from a point of view of putting together a movie, just putting together a movie, it's not a big deal if you understand the elements of making movie. Now, obviously, many people know that the director in an action movie, he does not choreograph the fight sequences. There is a fight choreographer and there is a fight stunt choreographer. So those are the people who are really in charge of putting together, or at least, you know, inventing and putting together the elements of the fight or the action sequence or the chase. The job, the task of the director, if he's not a stunt coordinator himself, is to interpret what he sees, what they give him, and to interpret it into a cinematic element. So, you know, the stunt, let's say the fight choreographer puts together a nice, beautiful fight, just like a dance choreographer will put together a dance. And now I come as a director, I see what they put together for me. I might have some comments. Can we change it here a little bit? Can we change it there? But again, it's not my expertise to put together a fight. Now, my job is to take it and put it on the screen in an exciting way. Because this is our job, the director, the editor, the director, the cinematographer. But the responsibility of the director is to take it and to put it on the screen. And if you understand the process of cinema, a director can do it. Now, of course, you need some kind of a touch, you know, maybe fondness for action. And because if you suddenly are asked to do a comedy and you're not funny as a director, I don't think you can do a comedy just because you understand the cinematic language. And you have to like horror pictures to kind of make horror. So I was already close to it. I love, you know, James Bond, let's say, for instance, I'm bringing James Bond, or Westerns, which are action movies. And James Bond is an action movie. And this is the type of movies that I always liked since childhood. So I was close to it. And then it was just a matter to implement everything I've learned through the years.
What was it like working with Sho Kasugi?
As I mentioned earlier, I've seen a lot of, or at least many samurai movies, Japanese samurai movies. And I was always fascinated by the style, by the, I would almost say the dance movement of the samurais, of the martial art, especially the samurai and the sword. And here I meet the Sho Kasugi, and I already seen the movie. He made already one movie for Canon, which was called Enter the Ninja. He was the villain in this movie. He played the villain. And here I meet him. He's a very tall fellow. For a Japanese man, he's very tall, taller than me. And obviously, he's the real thing. You know, he is a martial artist, trained martial artist. He's also trained in this ninjutsu, in this form of martial art. And he introduced me. He, you know, obviously, he saw, and I told him I don't know anything about this subject. So he introduced me to this world. He took me to see those Hong Kong style kung fu movie, martial art movie. He recommended for me some books to read about the ninjutsu, subject of ninjutsu. He introduced me to the weapon of the ninjutsu. And he was in our movie, he was the fight choreographer. So he put together the fight. And, you know, he was, by then, he was already a sensei. He was a master and he was a sensei, and he, the students followed him all the time. He had a group of students who worked with him on the movie. And, you know, they treated him like a sensei, like the teacher. And he put together the fight, as I said, as I told you. So now it was a question if we will work together in harmony, and I will translate to the screen in an exciting way what he puts together in front of me on the ground, you know. And it so happened that it worked. It works pretty good. Eventually, we know that the movie kind of the movie made it. It was picked up by MGM, which means that the fights were exciting. And today we know, I hear from many people that they were happy with the results, with the viewers who like this movie, those movies. The fights are put together in an exciting way. So this was here, was the combination that he was my teacher in terms of the martial art part of it, the action. And I was here, his teacher in terms of cinematic element or cinematic interpretation, if you would say so. And so we had this good relationship. We did not become personal friend in our private life. Unlike I'm still friend with Michael Dudikoff, let's say. We did not, Shokasugi and me. And he's very involved in his own martial art world. I'm talking about Shokasugi. And he has few businesses about it. And he was busy with the building his career, but we really worked together very well in putting it together. And another thing, a good thing about Shokasugi was that he understood that in cinema or the type of movies that we want to make, you cannot be too adamant about adhering to the martial art purity. You know, there are some movies that are, which are martial art movies, which are really very concentrated within the martial art techniques and discipline. And those movies are limited to very specific audience. So he understood what I wanted to do is to take a martial art movie and make it into a James Bond movie. So it's not pure martial art, but we have chases and we have fight and we have guns and we have other elements which are so-called general, which I call general Hollywood action. And he was keen. He was understood it, and he went along with me. And I, of course, went along with him when he did his fight. And beside this, he's a master performer within his in what he's doing. And it was pleasure for me. It was pleasure just to sit on the chair sometimes and just to watch him perform what he was doing, you know, working with the sword, working with his hand, with his feet. It was just, to me, it was like a ballet, just watching him. He is a master. His moves are beautiful. His hand and legs and were just beautiful, even just to watch.
You kind of did something that I would think is very difficult, because I seem to remember I liked Ninja 3 almost even more than the second Ninja film. I mean, it was a great mix of the supernatural with the ninja, the tropes that you've been working with. And that film was just, well, it was terrific, frankly.
Thank you. Here's what I think. I inherited from Shokasugi the idea that the ninjas, the ninjutsu, is a mysterious cult. It is, according to the Japanese history, tradition, martial art, those were shadowy people or groups of people. They were assassins. It was during the big battles between the shoguns in Japan, and the front people were the samurai. Those were the honorable fighters. But the shoguns needed assassins, people to do the dirty work. And that's how those ninjutsu and the ninja fighter have developed. They were not honorable like the samurais. So they were always in the shadow, in the underworld. and the way they operated was shadowy and mysterious. At least this is the legend today, the way we see it today, because we are talking about a few centuries back. And so I kind of took it into my heart that those movies, ninja movies, cannot be straightforward action. It needs element of mysticism and mystery and unknown and unclear stuff. So, you know, we did it a lot in the movie Revenge of the Ninja with Shoka Sugi. There are enough elements of this mystery. But in Ninja 3, The Domination, because of many reasons, we moved into the realm of exorcism and possession, which, in my opinion, just enhanced this type of a movie. I'm not sure that the martial art purists liked it and embraced what we did in the movie, but at least it works together, you know, mystery, possession, exorcism, in my mind, works together, works well with this mystery of ninjutsu. And that's how it happened.
And that was the first time, I think, that you worked with Lucinda Dickey. How was she to work with?
Correct. When we started to do this Ninja 3, The Domination, the movie, and it was determined that the hero will be a heroine, will be a female ninja, we started casting. And, you know, we saw actresses, we saw dancers, we saw martial artists, female martial artists. And, you know, we narrowed down to five or six of the young women actresses we saw. Eventually, we chose Lucinda Dickey to do the part. She was a dancer, trained dancer, so which means that they can teach her. If we are not using a martial artist, somebody like Cynthia Rothrock, so if we are using somebody else, we better use a dancer that they can teach her the move and she will pick it up very quickly. So she was, and she had the physiques, the look, you know, the look that the audience can believe that she can perform what she is performing, kind of broad shoulders, this type of a build. She was not too fragile. And this was the first movie we in Canon made with her before Breaking, despite the fact that the movie Breaking went to distribution before Ninja 3, The Domination. But the order of filming was that this was the first movie. And indeed, she picked up the moves very quickly. Whoever had to show her the moves of the fight, either it was Shoka Sugi, one of his assistants, or Steve Lambert, the stunt coordinator, she was athletic. She's very athletic. She's a dancer. She picked up all the moves. She did everything according, you know, according to our work, our schedule, our work discipline. Very professional, very disciplined. She done everything she had to do. It was we really worked in harmony in this movie. The schedule went along. Everything moved smoothly, especially with her. Shoka Sugi, on the other hand, was not very happy with the idea that he lost the the position of the hero of the movie. So with him, it came to some frictions here and there in the movie. But it was nice to work with Lucinda, and later on I worked with her again in Breaking 2 Electric Boogaloo.
I have a very silly question for you. Where did the Electric Boogaloo come from when it came to Breaking 2? Who came up with that idea?
There have been many essays written about the subject. What is this term, Electric Boogaloo? And there is a very, very good one that was written only about this subject, where the word Electric Boogaloo comes from. It's a very comprehensive and a good article about it. The writer really did his job, and he went back historically to the 60s, I think, where there was a television show, and I think it was a type of a move in the dancing before breakdancing. So everybody, had nothing to do with me, by the way. When I came into this project, the name was already attached, so I don't know. But when those people that wrote the interview, wrote this article, they interviewed Shabadoo, they interviewed Boogaloo Shrimp, and every one of the two of them had a different version where how did it became part of the movie. But the name of shrimp was Boogaloo Shrimp, so it was already there somehow. And in one of the version, and everybody's it's pretty known that when Canon Film was selling the idea of a second Breaking Number Two, they already used the phrase Electric Boogaloo, even before there was a script. So somehow they planted it in the mind of Menachem Golan, maybe when they were still doing the first Breaking. I don't know where it started, but there are a few versions. Shabadoo claims that he brought it with him from his television show. He had a television show before he did those movies. And so there was this move, and Michael Chambers, Shrimp, claims that it's his idea. It was part of his name, Boogaloo, Electric Boogaloo. But as I told you, there was some work done, historical work done, and this term was used way before the two of them with the Chuck Berry, very early in the rock and roll, the beginning of rock and roll, of black rock and roll.
So I suppose that you probably approached breakdancing the same way that you approached the fights that you had to shoot, and just it's a different matter of different choreography.
You're absolutely right. Again, we are saying the same thing again. You as a director, or in this case, me as a director, I have to look at the choreography. I'm not a dancer. I don't have any knowledge about it. We had a good choreographer, Billy Goodman, and he put together the dances together with Shabadoo, together with Shrimp, together with Lucinda, or other big dances with other people. And they present it to me. They show it to me. And because it's not even action, I don't. there is less that I can say anything about it. Because in action, we can build a little story. Every action sequence has a little story within itself. And I always insist that it will have a little story. Every action sequence will have a beginning, middle, and end with a resolution. And in dance, it's even less. So but still, we tried. We tried in every dance to have a little story going within it. Let's say the dancers begin here and they move to the other end, and there is a resolution at the end. So also beginning, middle, and end. But again, my job is to take it and with the cinematic element, put it on a screen that it will be exciting. So the audience that are watching it, they watch the dance and it's exciting for them. It's beautiful for them. It's aesthetic to the audience. And the choreographers, they just put the dance together on the floor. They do the best they can do. And the rest is our job, the cinema people, to make sure that it will look exciting, aesthetics, beautiful on the screen. So it's the same, basically, it's the same approach. There are a few different things, nuances, but basically it's the same thing. Filming a fight sequence or filming a dance sequence.
After Breaking 2, you moved on to work on American Ninja, where you worked with two of the actors that you would work with so many more times, Steve James and Michael Dudikoff. What was that relationship like with those guys?
When we started with American Ninja, and I say we, it's myself and the producers, Gideon Amir and Avi Kleinberger, we decided on an open call casting, which means that we are not only bringing in actors from agencies, but it's open. We just advertised it. Martial arts schools, actors with agents, actors without agents, whoever wants to come can come in. So we saw even just for the part of Michael Dudikoff, the American Ninja, we saw 400 young people. And, we narrowed it down. That's the way it works in casting. You narrow down, and eventually you the best people that you think are the best, you put them on tape. I must say, and now I'm talking about casting, and I must say truthfully, really, that when Michael Dudikoff walked in one instant, and Steve James walked into the room in the other instant, I had this feeling that those are the guys, instinctively, you know, before I even spend a lot of time with them. I had this feeling that those are this guy, Michael Dudikoff is the American Ninja, and Steve James is his sidekick, his buddy, you know. And eventually we ended up with them, you know. We got them, the company signed the deals with them. Now, both of them, Michael Dudikoff and Steve James, at the time were very enthusiastic young people, you know, action lovers. You know, both of them came from, they love action, they love physical movement. So right there on this level, there was no problem. They wanted to do everything themselves. They wanted to perform. They wanted to do everything, stunt themselves. They were very enthusiastic. And for reasons that are very hard to describe, because you don't know how it is, the three of us became very good friends, Michael, Steve, and myself. And we kept this friendship many years later. Unfortunately, Steve James died. With Michael, I'm still in contact until today, and we're talking 35 years later. And so this is one of those situations that it just happened. The chemistry is there. We all think alike. And even in making the movie, we were just like kind of thinking the same way. And it was hard work. We shot in the Philippines, very hot, 110, 120 degrees every day. The work was pretty hard. But there was this great enthusiasm there. And that's how the friendship was forged between the three of us. And it was just pleasure to work with them. And the two of them are physical, and they handle the action, and they're willing to take risk and to go the distance, anything to do it for that the action will look good. And, they disciplined, always on the set, on time, for rehearsal, for working, staying as late as we needed them. It was a great experience. In general, the first American Ninja was also a great experience because after a week or two, we started to see the material and rough editing and on the screen, and everybody felt that it's happening. You know that it is happening. That those two guys have a great charisma on the screen, Michael and Steve. When they have close up on the screen, you can see the charisma, and the bond between them. Could have really popped up on the screen. You feel it on the screen. You could feel the bond between them. And all of this while we were shooting. So there was already feeling that something good is happening here. And it worked for all of us.
I always felt that Steve James didn't necessarily get his due because I always thought he was such a great actor. And I was really glad to see him in Riverbend. I thought you did a terrific job with him.
Steve James came from New York, came to Hollywood from New York. He was a martial artist, physical guy, very great body, and a movie lover. He was a collector. He had a collection of 3,000 movies, so-called black movies, historically from the silent era. And he really, really wanted to be the next black action hero. He wanted to be the next chef. This was his goal. And he was on his way to do it. From the nature of thing that when we did the American Ninja, he was secondary to Michael Dudikoff. This was from the nature of the story. But later on, he got his other chances. He was part of the Delta Force movies. Luckily enough, suddenly the opportunity came that... And the right script that he, which is Riverbend, had a different name in the beginning, which he played the lead part, the lead role. He was very happy about it, that he had this chance to prove himself. Unfortunately, the movie was not too popular or successful in distribution. It's a very difficult subject, especially when we made the movies in the 80s. maybe today it would have been easier to distribute it. And but he got his chance, and then he continued, you know, not only with me, not only with Canon, making his way toward this goal of becoming a black action hero. But again, unfortunately, he died young, too early. And many people mourn this this death, that he didn't get the chance to become what he potentially could have been.
The one actor that it seems like you've worked with the most over the years, who I haven't asked you about, is John LaMotta. How did you guys meet? Because he was working on your earliest stuff.
John was my lucky charm. I had to add in every movie. The movie that I told you about, that Charlie Bent produced, that was called then The Eyes of Dr. Cheney. I think today's Mention of Doom, it's called, I think. Was directed by an actor, Michael Pataki. And we befriended, I befriended him. And he was the director. And years later, when I wrote the script for the movie One More Chance, that was produced, filmed when while I was a student in Loyola Marymount, I went back to this actor, Michael Pataki, that by then he already became even more famous, he got some bigger part, Raised the Titanic, other movies. And I asked him, you know, Michael, I have this script, I have no money, and I want you to play the lead role. So he read it, and he came back to me and said, listen, this role is not for me. This character is not me. But I know who can do it. I have a friend, an actor, who can do it. He's perfect for this. And this was Johnny LaMotta. So he introduced me to John LaMotta, or Johnny LaMotta. Johnny LaMotta came from New York to Los Angeles. He was a theater actor, a musical actor, was a musician, was singing, playing a piano, and a good theater actor. Later on, he got a television series, Elf, I think was the name of the show. And he became the main character of this movie, One More Chance. And we had to shoot the movie a year and a half. It took us a year and a half to finish just filming, shooting the movie, because we did it only in the weekends. And here and there in between, Johnny LaMotta got a job here and there in theater. So we had to stop until he finished the show and he was available again. And we really, really became good friends. Myself with Johnny LaMotta and David Womack, the producer, we all became very good friends. He always invited me to every theatrical show that he did. And from that point on, whenever I could have him in a part in any movie that I directed, I did so. He was an actor, you know, all he needed some instruction what to do. So in American Ninja, he's the sergeant. In Ninja 3 The Domination, he's one of the cops who is being killed. In every movie, he has a small part because I needed him, because he was the main actor in my first directorial job. So I felt that I need him with me all the time. And so we did, and we were a good friend. And he passed away just 2 or 3 years ago. We went to the funeral. But I saw him in many stage plays. And as I say, he was lucky enough to have a job in the television series Elf. And he worked all the time. He was one of those actors who were being invited all the time to television, parts in movies. It was pleasure to work with him. And the type of actor that later on in my career I met again, people like him, actors like him, that was nice to work with him.
So how does it feel having Marco Zitomon writing this biography of you and working with him on all of these stories and documenting your career now?
You know, our days in Canon, and I say ours, I don't mean only me, some other low-budget directors or medium-sized budget directors. In the 80s, there was a certain type of movies that were made, especially action and horror, which were low-budget, medium-budget. We used to call them low-budget. And they relied on the explosion of the home video. the studios did not take a notice that there was a lot of money in the home video, in the rental shop. And some independent companies like Canon and Corelco, they realized and they did it. And we did this kind of movies. And because they were not big budget, they kind of, they took a second part to the big studio movies. And especially when the studios eventually realized that there is good money in this type of movie. So they took over. They started to do, let's say, Ninja Turtles or the big Stallone movies. So the studio walked in and pushed out the independent. And the movies that we made kind of took a second role, second seat. Suddenly, and this, I'm talking 30 years ago, right? And now, in the last 3 or 4 years, there is a renewed interest in those movies. In the Canon movies, in the other companies' movies, the action movies I directed, the action movies that other directors directed, the Steve Carver, the early movies of Van Damme, the early movies of Schwarzenegger, and there is a renewed interest in them. And I'm getting a lot of requests for interviews, just like this one. And there was a documentary made about Canon, and the name of the documentary is Electric Boogaloo, the mystery of Canon, the mystery story of Canon, after this movie came out, there was even bigger renewed interest, and most of the movies, the company Canon Film Company went bankruptcy, and all the movies that I directed, or at least most of them, moved to MGM. MGM got the rights to those movies. And MGM, they came out on VHS cassette and later on DVD. And then, again, as I said, they kind of disappeared. Not completely. But lately, they're coming out in new reissue as a high definition, as a Blu-ray cassettes. So not directly from MGM. MGM is giving the rights to other companies to do it. And and since those movies came out again in the new and in those reissuing, they have me as in a commentary audio track, which is customary. And some of them have documentary, half an hour documentary of the making of attached to them. And there is an amazing, to my taste, an unbelievable renewed interest in those movies. And I'm getting used to it. In a way, I'm being invited to film festivals, which replay those movies. I was invited to do the soundtrack for American Ninja, for Avenging Force, for Second American Ninja, for European version of American Ninja. I just finished to do one for Avenging Force coming out in France, in a French version, and on and on. And interviews for magazines, for websites. I just did like 4 interviews for radio station live in Australia, one in Alaska. And then among all those people who contacted me was also Marco Siedelman. And he really called me initially when he said he wanted to write a book about Canon. And just by the way, I was not long ago, I was in Spain, in Madrid, for a film festival that I was invited. They screened 2 of my movies, and we did Q&A, introduction, the usual stuff that is done in film festivals. And then I met a company who already wrote 2 books about Canon film. In Spanish, in Spain, Canon Film and the second Canon Film. And now they're working on the 3rd book, only one company, Canon Film. So Marco called me and he already published 1 book about one of those film companies, Shapiro Glickenhaus, who were big in the 80s, Shapiro Glickenhaus Entertainment. And now he had in mind to do a movie about Canon. And as he was starting to work on it, he realized how big, how vast amount of material about this canon. And I started to work with him, and then he approached me one day. He said, listen, making a movie about canon is too big. I need several books. Writing a book, not movie. Writing a book about canon is too big of a task. I need few books in order to do it. So I want to concentrate only on the movies that you directed, meaning that I directed. And he believed that there was enough material in what I did to publish a book about it, and it will, in a nutshell, kind of characterize what happened in the 80s and the 90s in this type of movies. And so that's how I started to concentrate only in the work that I did on those two decades, the 80s and the 90s. And we started to cooperate on this book, and he interviewed me for many, many hours. I would say like 20 hours interviews. And then he started to interview other people who worked with me, creative people, producer, cameraman. So it's interesting. And when I think about it, it's not an ego trip. It's not about, somebody's writing a book about me. But I really believe that overall, the low-budget movie making is neglected. There is, of course, artistic independent movie making that gets a lot of attention. So there are low-budget movies, but they are what we call art house movies, artistic movies, and they get a lot of attention. Film festivals, magazine, write-off. But this area of low-budget genre movies, which mean low-budget action, low-budget horror, or another term, we call them B movies. They were neglected in terms of publication, mentioned in the history of Hollywood, and they were a big part of Hollywood, especially in the 80s and the 90s. There was another way back in the 50s, and that's where the term B movies come from, low budget B movies. But we are talking about the resurrection in the 80s and the 90s, that they were very popular all over the world. So this subject of the B movies, of the low budget action movies, is close to my heart, is dear to my heart. And I'm happy that now people are paying attention to it. And by the way, there is a reason why people are paying attention to it. And if you want, we'll talk about it. But that's why I cooperate with Marcos Edelman so much, because I want to make sure that those movies, the work of directors like myself and other, Albert Payun, I mentioned other, will not disappear completely and will be remembered. I know it is remembered by the fans, by the people who watch those movies until today, and they still rent them and buy them and collect them and watch them. And I know that there are even younger audience, young new audience for the American Ninja series. But it will be good if something will be written about it, and how the structure of the financial structure of the time, what was the distribution model of making those movies, what it took for us to make movies not outside the studio system. And I think it will be a great book, and I think an important in terms of this of the history of Hollywood, as one section of the history of Hollywood, which really canon film, you know, is the pinnacle of this.
Well, I'm curious, what is your thinking as far as why these movies are having this resurgence?
Well, we talk about it a lot. We talk about it among friends, among stunt people, among action fiction, action fans. Today, action movies of today, they are big budget. No, they are not big budget. They are humongous budget. The action movies of today are produced with a budget of over $100 million. Sometimes $200 million. That's a vast amount of money. It's unbelievable. And the action on those movies is actually spectacular. It's really indeed spectacular. When, you know, we are talking about the Bourne series, we are talking about the, of course, Superman, Spider-Man, Fast and the Furious, this type of movies. The action, even Lord of the Ring, if you want, the action is unbelievably fantastic in the visual, the way it's presented on the screen. But the way the action is produced is by means of a lot of computerized graphics, other elements assisting to produce this spectacular action with digital means. And therefore, they also, it's called for fast editing, quick editing. So what our feeling is, myself and other people, that, okay, you see the action and you see the star within it. You know, okay, the star has few close-up, but you sense this feeling that the stars, the actors did not really fight in those fight sequences or the action sequences. Another director, you know, you see those movies and suddenly it jumps to completely different style. And another director, and we know it for a fact, that's how it's done. Another director is now directing the second unit, and they do all the action using cable, using blue screen to so the actors will not have to work too hard, because the background can move instead of the actor moving or any other element, or they put them on cables. And therefore the editing is fast. And you get a sense when you go back and you see one of those movies that was done in the 80s, where we had to do the action physically. Our action, we didn't have any digital means. You know, in the movies we made, if Shokasugi had to be dragged behind the van, he was dragged behind the van. There was no way to produce it. We didn't know how to produce it digitally. He had to be on the ground, on the asphalt, being dragged behind it. Now, when you watch it, I believe that you can feel it. Sometimes, not necessarily intellectually, not necessarily consciously, but subconsciously, you feel that it's a different type of action. Here we have a fantastic, beautiful action with sequences and an element that cannot really happen in reality, you know. In the Fast and Furious, a car can jump between two buildings, passing over another building in the middle. You know, things which in reality cannot happen. And it looks spectacular, by all means. It's exciting. But it misses the punch, what I call the you don't feel the pain. As an audience, when you sit in the audience and you see those movies, you don't feel the pain. And suddenly, the old generation, and when I say old, they are not old, they are 40 years, 50 years old, they had a nostalgic, you know, when they see all these new action movies, and they kind of sometimes disappointed. So they had a nostalgic feeling to go back and to see an American Ninja, to go back and to see an early Van Damme movie or an early Stallone movie, where the action really happened in front of the camera. And there is a young audience that have seen a lot of the new movies, Superman, Spider-Man, or whatever, any other action movies. And suddenly they're rediscovering this other low budget, what we call the low budget movies. They don't necessarily know that it's low budget. And then they see an action which is greedy and long shot. The editing is not going crazy. Every shot is only 4 or 5 seconds, but rather you have shots of 25 seconds. Half a minute long, where you really see the fighters fighting and they really perform. So when you see Shokasugi, he's really doing what he's doing, and it's not a mean of some kind of graphic, digital computerized graphic, only his close-up and a close-up of a hand punching a stomach. We didn't have things like this. We really saw the action, and we try to stay as wide and as long, wide shot and as long as we can, like a ballet, to really try to show the choreography, to feature the choreography. That's why I think there is a resurrection and nostalgic resurrection and other type of resurrection to those kind of movies, and that they are being watched again.
Mr. Furstenberg, thank you so much for your time tonight. This has been terrific.
You're welcome. Now it's you that I'll be seeing.
Giorgio and stock up on some more Gucci. And it won't be hard. I got all the credit cards and I'm gonna buy me some new Nicole. Tennis 21, Nike's number one. They're in style. Diamonds are in.
They're girls' best friend.
Let's go get some.
This show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.